time that's gone by between then and now. So understand that I'm an old lady and I forget things. First of all, a little family history, because you have to know how the family came to Israel. Shortly after World War II, the Jews were making a great influx into the state of Israel, or as much as they could, or as much as they were allowed to. There was a lot of blockage put in their way as far as being admitted. But housing was desperately needed. And who would become my father-in-law, went to Israel with his small son, having just lost his wife, and decided, since he was a carpenter by trade, that he would help build housing for these people as they came in, because there was nowhere for them to go. They were stacked on top of each other, and unlike some of the other countries in the world after World War II, the Israelis wanted the people that came there to be free. They had had enough of living in concentration camps and being housed in ghettos and this kind of thing. They wanted them to come and be able to be as free as possible. So they didn't want to build camps and places for them. They wanted them to have homes. And this man and several of the men that he worked with went to Israel specifically for the purpose of doing this, having no thought of staying. But they became so enamored of Israel and the people there that they stayed. My father-in-law raised his small son there, who became my husband. My husband was married before me, had two children, and when the children were, the youngest was a year old and the second was about 2.5, I came into their lives because the wife had become ill and needed help. And she was over here in America trying to get some treatment for her cancer, and sadly it did not work. Here he was, a man already in the IDF, being called out all hours of the day and night. And in Israel, this works. There is a structure over there like you've never seen anywhere else. When they say it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a village to raise all Israeli children. Israeli children are raised with the idea that they can go to bed at night and their parents are there, and if they wake up in the morning, they may be even in someone else's house or having someone else there to care for them. And they know that those people have the same authority that their biological parents have. If they say, go to the other room and bring me a sack of potatoes, they darn well better get the sack of potatoes. It has to be that way. It has to be that way. Children are not able to live as free and unrestricted a life as far as learning how to be defensive. I'm not talking defensive in a psychological manner, but they have to know how to take care of themselves. They have to know when the sirens go off, if someone says to you, put a gas mask on, you've got to know how to do it, where they are, and do it now. When they say, go to the shelters, that means go to the shelters. That doesn't mean I've got to go get my iPod. Okay, we're back to my family. My husband grew up in Israel, became a member of the IDF. Everyone that lives in Israel is required to do at least 2 years of service. Not all of them will be combatants. Some will be librarians, some will be historians, some will be teachers, some will be caretakers, some will be nurses, and some will be doctors. But everyone does service to the state of Israel over there. It's just part of being Israeli. It's just part of being there. And you do it because you want to, and I did it for almost 23 years. Instead of two. Of course, a lot of that included schooling, because when I went over there, I had no training whatsoever to do the job that I ended up doing. I ended up as a defensive strategist, and most of my job did not require me to be a combatant. The few times that I did have to actually go out and carry out any kind of combatant role, I will remember the rest of my life. And they aren't times that I would have chosen for myself, but they are times when I did what I had to do. My husband had been in it for quite some time, even before his wife passed away. And it was normal and it seemed natural for us to continue caring for those two children. They, by this time, kind of thought of me as a substitute mother anyway. And children, like I said, children over there do not restrict their biological parents as being the only ones that they love. Children love anyone that cares for them. We decided to go ahead and make a family with us, you know, and day after day after day went on. You know, I had grown up in a family that was just the opposite of what I would have wanted for it. My parents were Jewish, but my father had fought in World War II and gone through Europe and saw the fate of the Jews over there. And my parents got married right after he got home, after the war, and they decided that it was in their best interest to suppress the idea of being Jewish. They wanted no part of it, and they didn't want anyone to know. So we, as children, were not really brought up as much of anything. You know, we really weren't Christian. We weren't Jewish. We weren't anything. And it took my husband to bring out the Jewishness in me as far as knowing what I was and where I came from and what my heritage was. My family was horribly abusive. I think a lot of it came because they couldn't tell anyone who they really were. And it was a load on them that they couldn't bear. And when my husband married me, he said to me, "As long as I have breath in my body, you will never have to see these people again." And so we left America, went back to Israel, and I took up life there, and I was a fish out of water. Didn't have any idea of, you know, what I was going to do. All I knew was there were two children that needed me. And I enlisted in the IDF simply because I thought, well, this is a requirement. You know, let's see what we can do. Thinking that maybe they would find a role for me in some way that I really wouldn't have much authority or any kind of responsibility. And somewhere along the line, someone saw in me the talent to teach people how to defend themselves. So I started out going around to the schools teaching children what you do when the sirens go off, what you do when somebody says, put on a gas mask, how you make sure that it's right, how you make sure that it's going to work. Children became kind of an obsession with me for a while. And then my husband was called to do some intelligence work. And there were times when he needed another person with him. It was more advantageous to be a couple than to be a single man or a single woman. And so I have been a Muslim wife. I've been, you know, I've been a lot of different things in my life. I've eaten kosher. I've eaten terribly unkosher. But you do what you've got to do to protect the country. And in order to do what they need to have done, there's times when you're a little less Jewish, not in your heart, but for the world to see. We had losses, and every loss that we had, I felt, was a failure on my part because I hadn't taught that person to defend themselves correctly. And to make a long story short, we did this. This was our life. We had people under us. I had every night. It was unusual not to have 40 or 50 people in our home for dinner. I had this contraption on the roof that was what they called a rooftop cooker. And kind of like a poor man's crock pot, only much bigger. It was like someone, the roofs in Israel in the older houses are very, very, very deep, because otherwise there's no air conditioning. You would literally cook in your house if you didn't have a lot of something between you and the sun. And there was a huge piece of round, like cement, that had a metal part with a hook in the center of it. And you would take that out and either put it in a fire or heat it in your oven, preferably not, because then you have the house heated up, and that's the whole idea behind it. But somehow the men would get it heated for me and take a hook, a long metal hook, and carry it up to the rooftop and put it down in this pit that was lined with cement. And everyone who came to my house the night before had brought carrots or potatoes or turnips or onions or some kind of meat, whether it be chicken or beef or whatever we could scrounge together. And whatever there was went into these great big huge steel pots. And they got lowered down into this hole with this hot stone. And then you would cover it over with mats of cloth and palm leaves and anything else that you could find to cover it over, and go to work. Crockpot. You know, and then we would come back home. The men would go up, take the pots out, bring them down. We would all eat to our fill. And then while the men sat around and talked after the meal, the women would look over what had been brought for the next day and work up anything that needed to be worked up, prepare a sweet so that anybody with a sweet tooth would have something at the end of the meal, and get ready to start it all over again. Hopefully without being called out. But you always had to have a backup. You always had to have a backup. Because you could put the stuff down in the hole and go off to work, and the world could come apart. And nobody would be there to lift the stuff back out of the hole, and it would be a shame to let that food go to waste. So there was always a backup plan. And I think planning is something that a lot of people don't do anymore. And I've had someone here not very long ago tell me, live in today. Well, I can't live in today. I've got to live out there, because that's just the way. When you do something for 25, 30 years, you don't just, it's done. I can live here now. This is it. You know, no problem. And then the unthinkable happened. I send my husband off to work one day, and all he's going to do is take a bus to go somewhere. And the bus explodes. It was 25 years ago this last week. And I was not even 40 years old. The children were grown. I mean, they weren't at home anymore. And all of a sudden, there was just me. And because of circumstances beyond anyone's control, I've never grieved. I've never really given this man, who was so important in my life, the proper, what I would think of, proper honor and dignity of other people knowing what a wonderful man he was. It's one of the reasons I'm here talking to you today. And I need other people to know how very blessed I was to have had the life I did. Yes, we went through wars and we went through conflicts, and I'm going to be real honest, I have killed people. And I remember the faces of every one of them. And God, thank you, this has never happened to you all here in America, but don't rest on your laurels and think it can't.
Amen. It's the truth.
Anyway, I started trying to put my world back together, and I got up every day, and I went to work, and good, strong Jewish woman that I was not going to let this get to me. I was not going to let it tear my world apart. And this went on for a few years, and my son's plane was shot down. And they never found a body. It was such a bad wreck. And everything that I had done, everything I'd gone through, it was kind of like the last straw. And I started having strokes and problems with memory, and pretty soon the Hebrew was gone. I couldn't remember Hebrew. I couldn't remember the language at all. And I tried tutors, I tried all kinds of things, but I was simply stressing myself out more and more and more and more, trying to get it back. And everyone over there speaks English. It wasn't like I was an island on, marooned and couldn't communicate with anyone, but I couldn't do what I needed to do for my job. And I didn't realize that it was actually strokes that I was having, because I wouldn't lower myself to go and get checked out. It wasn't until I had a much more massive stroke in 1997 that I found out that I'd been having them. And it did something to the center of my brain that allowed me to retain a learned language. And it's kind of funny, because Nancy was talking to me this morning, and she said something to me, and it was like, oh, okay, I know that, And this is the very first time in 25 years, or not quite 25, it'd be about 23 years, that I understood what she was saying and didn't have to think about, well, what is this in English? Two words. Now, I'm not saying that I understand Hebrew miraculously. I don't. And if anybody tries to talk it to me, I'll probably look at you like, yeah, what are you saying? But I'm gonna try to get it back. But anyway, I have been back in the States now since, to tell you the truth, dates are kind of foggy. But I came back here, and my friends in Israel, because they didn't know what kind of a life I had had before I came to Israel, didn't realize that it probably wasn't the healthiest thing in the world for me to go back to my family. So, being that they were trying to make all the arrangements and everything, they sent me right back to them. And I went through several years of abuse, thinking that I didn't have any way out. And a friend of mine down here in Tallahassee a couple years ago told me, you are getting out of there. You are getting out of there. Second time in my life I've been rescued. Second time. And she saw to it that I had an apartment here. She went out and bought me what furniture she could. Got me set up. I came here with what I could pack in two suitcases. Everything else was gone. I'd gone through chemotherapy for cancer, and it wiped everything. I had nothing left other than just the clothes that I could pack in the suitcases and a few items that I thought I was really going to need, like a diet scale because I'm diabetic and stuff like that. And you know what? TSA took those things out of my bag and didn't give them back. So I had clothes when I came here, clothes. Clothes and a tube of toothpaste. And I have a fairly, you know, it's not a luxurious home now, but I can live there. I have my needs. And this is something else that I've learned in the last several years is needs are important. Luxuries and wants really aren't. They're not. If you have something that is a necessity for life or a necessity to be able to get through life, that's one thing. But just because, oh, gee, I'd sure like to have a banana. Well, you know, it's kind of foolish to walk a mile to the store to get a banana. Now, if you really needed that banana, if you were low on potassium and, you know, your heart was missing every other beat or something like this, I'd say I'd crawl to the store for a banana. But I have lost a lot of my spoiled nature over the years. And I'm not tooting my own horn when I say this, but I actually think a lot more of other people than I do myself. And when people do something nice for me, it's very hard for me because I think I don't really deserve that. And I have, until I talked to Rabbi last week, I have not talked to anybody about my son, my husband, and actually not many people about my life over there. Now, I have a lot more stories. Don't get me started. But, you know, and not every day was a bad day in Israel. Every day, most every day was a good day in Israel, even if we were having problems. But people over there can't rest on their laurels and say, you know, we're gonna do this and it's set in stone and, you know, everything is written in maple syrup over there. I mean, even when they schedule weddings and this kind of thing, unless it's a funeral, you can't really know when it will be until it happens. Now, I'm hoping, I haven't been there for 20 years, I'm hoping that they've been able to change enough, because I was there during the really turbulent period where we were a little past World War II, and the people that were coming in being immigrants were not the sick, really desolated people that there had been for so many years. I mean, for years, that was a society of people that were unable to care for themselves. By the time I got there, not only were they able to take care of themselves, but Israel knew how to be God's country. We fought through some battles that we were not supposed to win, people. And none of us that went out thought we would. There's something about confidence in ourselves that we lacked. We did not have confidence in ourselves, but we had a lot of confidence in God. And just as he had done with Joshua and with David, he saw that we won the battles that we had to win to stay there. And I told Rabbi, I have a terrible time not getting political. So if I get too political, shut me off. But it breaks my heart to see the things that are happening now. It breaks my heart.
Yes.
Now, Israel will be okay. It will. It may not be great, but it'll be all right. Because they're still God's country. Mm-hmm. I fear for the people, but I don't fear for the country. The country will be there. I'm sorry, Rabbi. I've run out of things to say for right now. Is there anything else that anybody would like to know? Or
you said that your husband and yourself were the intelligence. Was it the Mossad?
He was Mossad. I was kind of like the marionette. It was difficult for at that point in time. You know, a married operative didn't usually take a single female, and not very many married females were in that line of work. And generally, all I had to do is go along and be the silent wife, and not insult these people that handed me food that wasn't kosher, and that kind of thing. You know, you had to. I had to have a little bit of training to know what not to do, but not much in the way of knowing what to do. I did not carry a gun on any of those missions. I've only had one mission end because of me, and that was because I found out I was pregnant and I was just not able to do it. But, you know, the work that my husband did took him all over the world. And because don't ever mistake it, Israel operates everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're not, at the time that I was there, I mean, most people do not realize how tiny Israel is.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was even tinier. We had areas of that country that were no more than 12 miles wide. You can travel across Tallahassee and go further than that. There were, at the longest point during the time I was there, from the length of Israel, at the longest point was 96 miles. We could go, okay, the widest point on the width, the widest point was 32 miles. So now, when they talk about giving back all these territories that we, while I was there, won, I want to scream no, 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 because those Arabs that chose to, and the one, now, don't get me wrong, I'm going to tell you something that may surprise you. The Arabs that were actually living around us at the time that Israel became a country were our friends.
Amen.
The children lived and played and knew each other as brothers. They went to school together. There was none of this backing off and, you know. It's the ones that came in after Israel became a nation that flooded into these countries and took over the governments and took over. And pardon my French, but it was the UN. Because for so long, the people of Israel, even though they were declared a nation, were not able to do what they needed to do for themselves. So the people that have lived there all their lives were not our enemies. But the territories that they held became quicksand for us. And so it either was going to have to be Israeli territory, or eventually we'd have disappeared. Because you can't depend. You can depend on your neighbors, you can depend on your friends, but you cannot depend on the people they bring in.
Any other questions?
What was the span of years that you were there?
I went over there shortly after 1968 started, and was there until the first time I left was 1992, and I went back shortly after that for a short period of time and was there just a few months. But for the most part, 1968 to 1992. Now, I had some years where I was in school outside of Israel, but for the most part, those were my years. They were interesting years. They were monumental years, and I am not saying that, you know, gee, I was there and helped make the whole thing happen, but, you know, everybody worked together. Everybody worked together, and lately, I've wondered if if that's still the case, if everyone does work together over there. It's, you know, there seems to be, politics seem to be interfering more and more in every nation anymore, so.
Any other questions for us?
How did your faith impact you as far as bringing you through all of the grief?
I haven't had any. 25 years I've been mad. And I really, this is why I talked to Rabbi last week. I said, I really think it's because I have never grieved for these people. I've never let myself feel the whole thing because I had to be strong. And the 20 years that I lived in the Midwest, there were no temples around. There were no Jews around. I had gone to some Christian churches, and I'm going to tell you right now, it wasn't for me. I just couldn't get anything out of it. Another reason why I was thinking that, you know, maybe Tallahassee would be the place for me is because I knew there was a Jewish community here. Now, after 20 years back in the States and everything that's gone past in the last 20 years, I'm not sure that I'm really much of anything at this point, but I do know that this place feels like home to me. Amen. So I'm, you know, have talked to Rabbi about becoming a member here. We're going to see about it. I've got some work to do because people, I've lost more knowledge than I have left. Let's put it that way. There's a whole lot that I don't know in this world, and so we're gonna see if an old dog can learn some new tricks. This has all been off the cuff today, people. I hope it's not been.
It's been a blessing. Thank you for sharing. Thank you.
Stay put for a second. Would you mind if